to another episode of Wisdom Chat Plus. I'm Phil Holdsworth, your co-host, and my wonderful co-host. Over to you, Rachel.
Hi, Phil. How are you doing? I'm Rachel Surtees, and I'm also known as the Rambling Psychotherapist.
Brilliant. And lovely to see you again, Rachel.
Likewise.
And our wonderful guest today, Kate Wall, who's a nutrition coach. And we've also got Sarah Gardner, who's a freelance HR consultant and workplace mediator. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for giving your time this afternoon.
Thanks,
Phil. It's a pleasure. We're going to be talking today about the whole thing to do with, is well-being only for the wealthy? And Rachel, I know you wanted to invite Kate and Sarah on because of obviously what they bring. Where would you like to start?
Well, I'm going to start by inviting Kate and Sarah just to let us know a little bit about what it is that they do. So Kate, do you want to tell us what your work is?
Yeah, so I'm a registered nutritionist, previous nurse, and I run a nutrition consultancy business. And the main mission of it's Kate Wall Nutrition, and the main mission of the business is to help women to move past those kind of emotional barriers to being able to change the way that they eat. So really looking at long-term sustainable behaviour change, helping them to build self-acceptance, increase compassion, and move towards a life without food rules and restrictions. So that's what I would kind of do in my one-to-one clinic. And then alongside that, I do some corporate work as well. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
Wow, thank you. And Sarah?
Yeah, so I basically provide HR services to a variety of different business types. I tend to say I help small businesses keep their employees happy because happy employees are more productive and tend not to take them to tribunal. And the workplace mediation is offered either as an alternative to the grievance process, which in my experience doesn't really deliver anything, or post-grievance process. And that's focused on if there's been a relationship breakdown, trying to repair that so that the two parties can work positively together. And that's really important at the moment because of the tight candidate market that exists, where employers don't really want to lose people that are good just because they've had a falling out.
I guess that already takes us into the realms of kind of emotional, mental and emotional well-being already, but I'm going to wind us back just a little starting point. So the reason that I wanted to cover this topic in particular is in part because of my history, in my career history. So I've been a holistic therapist since 2006 and found my way into psychotherapy a number of years ago. So it's only really in recent times that I've become a psychotherapist and started to focus more on people's mental and emotional well-being. And well-being is really, really important to me. And I recognise that like well-being is individual to each person. You know, what does well-being mean to each person is individual to each person. But what I'm seeing in the wellness industry is that there's this huge industry springing up, and like it feels like every man and his dog is turning into some kind of well-being coach. And there is so much choice out there available about how you can look after well-being. You know, that you can do it through nutrition, you can do it through supplements, you can do it through exercise, you can do it through mindfulness, you can do it through all of these different options. And then obviously we're also going through a cost of living crisis as well. So with so much choice available to us and with budgets getting tighter, I started to think about like, you know, who is it that's paying for these things? How do we make good choices about what we invest in monetarily as well? And also I was thinking about the trend that seems to happen, that when things get difficult, things get challenging, people tend to drop well-being. So especially when money gets tight, see, well-being seems to be one of the things that goes by the wayside first, and yet is at the foundation of us functioning well. So I figured you guys might actually be really, really helpful in supporting us to explore this. So I was listening to actually a podcast that Andrew Huberman was on, and he reckons that the five foundations to full function are sleep, light, movement, nutrition, and having our social needs met. I figured that might be a good place to kind of get us started. So Kate, what would you say are the foundations of well-being for you?
I do like to think of it in a broader context, and I use a concept in my clinic called flourishing health, which kind of encompasses thinking about health in terms of the physical side, which is the bit that a lot of people think of and then forget some of the rest of it, but also in terms of the psychological, social, and philosophical. So I do a lot of values-based work as well, so that people are actually trying to live lives that align with the person they want to be and the life that they want to live, rather than what they think they should be doing. So I think that kind of taking it out and thinking, actually, we can't necessarily have health or wellness without a sort of package of things. So if we literally focus, obviously I'm a nutritionist, if we just focus on nutrition, we could eat the best diet in the world, but if everything else is out, then we're not going to feel good in ourselves. Or if we're doing nutrition goals at the expense of our mental wellness or our income or whatever it is, then again, we're not going to get that balance of wellness. So I think it's a whole host of things. It's definitely multifaceted. And as you say, it's sometimes individual. What someone will prioritize within their well-being will be different to others. And the one bit that people don't often think about as part of well-being, I suppose, is that financial health as well. But all of these things have areas in which we can control some of it, and some of it we cannot control. And that means we're limited in our choices and potentially less able to sort of reach that optimum in terms of health or well-being. I guess that would be my opening thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, financial well-being, I think if I were to add into the Andrew Huberman idea, because I sort of agree with all of those five foundational things as being at the centre of how we keep ourselves well, I think financial is really important as well, because it feeds our ability to stay well on a purely financial level. You know, we need the ability to buy food, we need the ability to buy shelter, we need the ability to heat our homes, we need the ability to get around the place, you know. But also that feeds our mental well-being as well. Phil, I'm sure you've got something to say on this.
Yeah, I think the thing that I often come across is what I would say, and I'll say it straight, and that is a misconception of what financial well-being is. And we're always, I suppose in any aspect of well-being, we'll always look at the externals, but we won't necessarily look at the main drivers behind how we treat ourselves, how we treat, you know, the external things like money around us and so on. And so my thing is about encouraging people to understand what's the main driver. The main driver is you and me, the people who make the choices. And why do we choose the way that we do? Why do we behave the way that we do with money or any other aspect of our lives? Why do we make those choices? Where do they originate from? So the assumption is it's just a choice here and now, and that choice is being determined by the controlling mechanisms around us, like whether we've not got enough money or something. We say, well, it reduces our choice, but it doesn't stop you being able to choose. Mm. And, you know, now our view of money, how certain things happen in our lives that trigger behaviours that are automatic, but we don't recognise them because they are habits. They're automatic. And so we just assume this is me. And in actual fact, that you comes from somewhere, and it's understanding where does that come from and can you rewrite it so it serves you well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you and I have spoken like outside the podcast arena on many an occasion about fundamental beliefs and stories that we tell ourselves, which inform our behaviour. I'm sure, Kate, that you've had much experience of this in the work that you do as well, that generally people have a set of beliefs and stories that they tell themselves that inform how they behave throughout the whole of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about what happens for people when money gets tight. So what happens for people when money gets tight? Why do we stop? And I will put my own hand up here. You know, why do we stop looking after ourselves quite so well, you know? And is it a perception that actually, we, in order to look after ourselves, we have to invest financially in ourselves? And is there ways around that, actually, that don't involve any more input from us, any more effort from us?
This is just my view. I think that when money gets tight, we focus on the fact that we are worried about the impacts of that lack of finance. That takes so much bandwidth that the other stuff drops off.
I'd agree with you as well, Sarah. And because at the end of the day, it's understandable. People would worry, but it's how all of a sudden everything else sort of disappears and the primary focus is that area of worry. And we know that when people are in that position, it's very difficult to problem solve or be creative. And so it's almost as if you get kind of sucked down into this black hole of despair. And assume you're the only one and there's no light at the end of the tunnel, which in both cases is not necessarily true.
But and I would say that that's the case in any crisis situation. It just slows your bandwidth down. And your anxiety gets built up and something falls off then.
Yeah,
you've got less space available for the things that don't feature in the front of your imagination.
Is there anything that, from a nutritional point of view, is there things that people can do that are, you know, not expensive in a sense? You know, they're quite sort of cost effective, but that would actually help promote good sort of abilities to think more clearly. Are there practical things that people can do?
This is another area where there is a lot of hype within the wellness space, you know, how to eat for good mental health, how to cure depression with nutrition, and you cannot do that. You just can't. So there's a lot of overinflation in that area. So anybody that is selling that, just sort of walk on by. But I think it's kind of thinking about just the basics from that point of view. So obviously, if you eat regular meals, then you're going to maintain blood sugars, which is going to feed your brain, which is going to allow you to think a little bit more clearly. Getting the right balance of foods will help your body to function. So those, you know, those basic kind of rules, hydration, just drinking regular glasses of water, all of those things are definitely going to help you to manage, not to probably manage emotions, but just to help to take off one less thing. But then I would be aware that not everybody even has that choice. You know, if you're choosing food on your plate or food on your child's plate, then, you know, we have to be conscious not everybody can eat three meals a day. And when you're saying about this thing of sort of the financial health, this is where it just ripples down, because, you know, depends how far down the line someone's gone. But, you know, I think food prices have gone up 20% in 1 year, meaning some people are having to pay about 45% of their income on food, which is a huge proportion. That would be to have a healthy, balanced diet. It would end up being about 45% of their monthly income. So things you would need to be able to have the best diet on a low income is education. How do I cook, for starters? If you can't cook and you haven't been taught that, which we don't tend to do in this culture, very difficult to know what to do with the basic ingredients. Have you got somewhere to store your food? Have you got a cooker? Have you got a freezer? You know, all these things a lot of us take for granted. So I think it's just being conscious that not everybody has the choices to do these basic things. And just sort of going back to what was being said before in terms of, you know, what drives behavior and this kind of lack of being able to use that logical mind when we're stressed, and obviously finance is one of the biggest stresses. There's also, I think, an element of, and I see this in my work in terms of weight stigma, but there's stigma around finance, around you know, social status. So you may have been made to feel you're not worth the effort, or you feel yourself, just based on societal norms, that you're not worth it. So sometimes people don't even, what's the point in bothering with well-being when I'm less than, I'm not good enough, I'm not as worthy as others with money. So it's even changing that kind of cultural approach to how we treat and you know, judge people who perhaps don't have as much money as they do. I suppose that's not quite answering the question, but I think they're just important points to raise.
No, but thank you. That's helpful. I think that, like you say, these are big subjects, aren't they? But what we're really trying to get to the bottom of is, we're trying to take all the myths out, or tackle the myths, but also get to the nitty-gritties. I mean, in the workplace, for example, we know that poor well-being has a direct impact on productivity, engagement, you know, it increased absenteeism through stress-related illnesses and so on. And you're right, Kate, about finances being one of the biggest stressors. And I say one of, because obviously life's full of lots of other things as well. But Sarah, in terms of the workplace, this must be something quite challenging for employers to get a handle on. And yet one thing that shocks me sometimes, and I suppose I shouldn't be, that is when I get an employer saying to me, oh, that's all the touchy-feely, fluffy stuff. You know, and I just think, I just want to slap them round the chops when they say stuff like that, because I just think you clearly don't know how to empathise. And for whatever reason, that they themselves have got their own beliefs. But I don't know what your experience has been, Sarah, in some of those areas, and whether you've had to tackle some of those types of managers.
I'm so sorry, somebody just came to the door.
don't worry. Did you hear what I said?
Yeah, so I think they do struggle. They do struggle with that. But it's also about prioritisation in terms of, if their budgets are tight, and a lot of the small businesses are struggling at the moment, so it's prioritisation and where they can actually, if they can afford the investment. And when they look at the bottom line of, for example, some employee benefits packages, they'll look at the price per person per month. But what they won't necessarily factor in is, I don't know how familiar you are with some employee benefits packages, but you can get some like massive discounts for supermarkets, kind of like between 6% and 10%, depending on the benefits platform that you go for.
That
can be a massive kind of way of not having to put the money on the salary. It's voluntary, and the one thing that I have found when I've supported businesses to implement those kind of platforms, encouraging the employees to take up those discounts, because it's effort, it's another job that they have to do, that's the hardest thing around that.
One of the things that I have come across actually quite often when I've been speaking to people who run EAPs and employee benefits services is that they say that, you know, we can provide you with the services, we can provide you with a discounted gym membership, we can provide you with the supermarket discounts, we can provide you with health insurance, but you know, those things are there, they're available for all the employees, but employees come to us and say, well, nobody's using it.
That's exactly the problem, Rachel, and it takes continual kind of promotion internally. But even if you've got your, you know, a dedicated HR team pushing those kind of things all the time, it's you need the leaders in the business to encourage the conversations around it. So particularly with things like EAPs, remembering that if somebody phones in and they say they're having a mental health scenario, or they're suffering with stress, or even if they have a conversation to say really struggling financially, managers remembering to signpost people to those benefits if they're provided, because it can't all be down to one department or one individual to push it across all of the businesses, all of the business, depending on the size of business.
I guess what you're talking about is that you know, within organizations it sounds like well-being needs to be part of the culture, and I mean, I'll speak from personal perspective, for many years my well-being didn't feature as the most prominent thing for me in my life, and it wasn't part of my own personal home culture. And it's only by having made it so that it's become such a prominent thing for me, and I've recognised the value of investing in my well-being. So I'm wondering whether or not there's something cultural that we're talking about here, that, you know, well-being is seen as something that's a luxury rather than something that's absolutely fundamental to us performing and surviving well.
I don't think there is enough conversation around well-being in the workplace. I think people will use the term because at the moment it's quite a current term, but actually discussing what that means to them individually, what that means to the team, and certainly getting people managers to have a genuine interest in their team's well-being, and having those when they're doing the regular one-to-ones, rather than just talking about how they're getting on in the work, the performance, you know, how's the project doing, actually being interested in their wider well-being. How are you feeling? How are you sleeping? You know, is there anything on your mind that you want to share? And some people won't want to do that in the workplace. Some managers will be nervous that it be seen as prying. You know, so there are barriers to that.
One of the things that's really struck me, and I've seen sort of more and more, is our, as a society, our penchant for measuring everything. We've got to be able to measure it. And I think one of the things that I've come across oftentimes is employers, for example, struggle to know how to, you know, sort of almost like justify well-being, because they're thinking, I can't measure it, and because they've not necessarily made the connections with other aspects, not just in the workplace but in the home life and so on. I think you're right, Sarah, there's a lack of perhaps understanding of what real well-being is about, but also this, it's societal. We've been driven down this route that anything successful, we can measure it. If we can't measure it, then we just, it's not worth even considering. And so how do you sort of measure well-being? I think, you know, that will be an interesting one to say, in terms of how we justify promoting good well-being and the right kinds of well-being, how would we do that? And how could we assign that to something that people could, would be tangible for them, you know, in terms of like an employer being able to measure something tangible within the workplace? If we have got the well-being approach right, what would we be seeing in the workplace, as opposed to if we're not tackling well-being, what are the opposites are we seeing?
You should be able to see increased productivity, but that assumes you've got your productivity measurements in place and where they should be. You should also see lower levels of absenteeism. You should see lower turnover, because if they're happy and feel supported in the workplace, they're not going to want to leave. And you should, depending on whether it's a co-located working environment or not, if it is in an office-based environment, you feel it, you sense it. When you walk into an organisation where there is positive well-being generally, you see, you just feel it.
Mm. Yeah.
I feel like something here, yeah, a bit, that we have to quantify the results of well-being in order to see it as something that we justify investing in. I know for myself, it took a little bit of a health crisis for me to really take that seriously. And, you know, I started to see the benefits almost immediately of changing my diet, changing my exercise routine, making sure that I get enough downtime, making sure I get enough sleep, et cetera, et cetera. But I had something to measure it against. So I had health improvement to measure it against. Mm. So I'm wondering if that's something that you see an awful lot of, that people need to kind of quantify what the results might be in order to want to invest in their well-being.
Yeah, this is, you know, classic within any part of well-being. And, you know, the classic one in my clinic is people previously have said tried to lose weight, and that's how they're quantifying success, when actually that doesn't equal always success or health. And so trying to look at how you measure progress when you're talking about increasing compassion and decreasing self-critical thoughts and improving diet, but, you know, on a gradual basis, so you don't suddenly go, wow, I can really feel the difference. It's a gradual thing over time. So you can do things like measuring energy levels and mood levels. And I think, you know, these can be ways of looking at a trend over time. But people do want to see that they're making progress. I think that is something that's important. But actually, when you get to work with people, and not everybody gets this opportunity, I suppose, but when I work with people, they come with one set of thinking that they need to measure everything and keep track of everything. And they soon realize, actually, I just need to focus on how I'm feeling in the moment and respond to that accordingly. And that's what I would sort of help people to have the tools to do. So if the culture within an organization is right, then maybe you could move away from this kind of quantifying and measuring and putting numbers to it. But in the end, businesses are businesses, and they need to make sure that they can make money. But it's the same as anything within the wellness field. You know, there's very much a rhetoric of it's individual responsibility. And of course, we do all have an individual responsibility for ourselves. But because some of us have less choices than others, we definitely need to think of more of an upstream approach, whether that's from government down, or whether it's from, like you said, the leader of an organization down, because there's that classic example when they're saying about the people all falling in the river and there's the person trying to drag them out and they're kind of half drowning and not being able to get them all out. And it's the person that goes up and blocks the hole in the bridge and stops people falling in the river in the first place that actually has success. So if you are able to think prevention rather than cure within your organization when it comes to well-being, then yes, you may be investing in something that you got to put some faith in that it's going to give back in the future. You're not going to see that immediate effect overnight, but in the long term you are going to get that that benefit. And it's recognizing that, yeah, it's not all down, you know, when you said a lot of people say, oh, I'm giving these benefits but nobody's using them. I hear that all the time. People say to me, oh, I told this person what to do with the nutrition and they just didn't do it, so they say they're the failure. Well, actually, if you're the leader or the coach or whatever it is, why is that person not using that benefit? So that might just not be relevant to them at this time. That might not be their in. That might not be what they see as a solution. And when you tell people what to do, they tend to sort of say, I'm not doing that. So it's understanding how to motivate people to want to make a change rather than doing something they think they should or they're being told to. So helping them to understand they have got the ability to do it, the support, why this is something that's important to them, not something that's important to the manager. Giving them all the opportunities, whether that's training, education, support, whatever. You know, motivation is not just, has that person got enough willpower? It's multi-layered and there's many different areas to consider, which perhaps sometimes is missed. And they think in business, it's often like, tick the box, I've done a workplace wellbeing, lunchtime learn, tick, I've done wellbeing. Oh, well, that person didn't listen to any of the advice, therefore it's their fault, we've done our bit. So yeah. If you can see what I'm saying, actually, it's understanding how to change people and bring them on board and recognize it's not all down to that individual, it's a joint approach that's required.
I get that quite regular. I was, the reason why I was smiling then, Kate, when you were saying what you're saying, is I'd just written down tick box. And I get it all the time with businesses saying to me that we want to support our employees with their well-being. Can you do a financial well-being session over lunch? And I'm just thinking that in itself rings not support for many. You could be forgiven for thinking then that's just a tick box exercise. It doesn't really mean anything to anyone. But it's frustrating at times when you have that approach because there's just a wanting to be seen to be doing something, but it's not necessarily the right thing. And making the assumption that all these things are right. So, for example, a gym membership to my wife would be absolutely meaningless because she hates the gym. So to think that that would be a good well-being exercise in her situation, you know, would be a nonsense, as perhaps some of the other things that they come up with in the benefits package. Now, they're right for some people, but not everybody, but I would imagine you both have come across this and see it with regards to business's approach to well-being and trying to fix it, making assumptions and not really asking the questions.
Yes, and I absolutely do. And one business owner that I was working with said he wanted a well-being strategy. I said, well, what problem are you trying to fix? Because they hadn't done any research into what areas weren't they being supportive. They hadn't looked at what, you know, he just heard the word and says, I want that in my business. Well, it's not going to be effective until you define the problem you're trying to fix. have you got a high absenteeism level? Well, no. Okay. So what is it that you're wanting to do for your people? But there is also the push and pull. The employers, and Kate's right, you know, it's not as simple as kind of giving information and assuming that people are going to be motivated to do it. But how much duty does an employer have to take their people that way? You know, when they're a business and they're trying to produce a product or a service and essentially make money so that the economy goes and they can pay their people and they're part of that and the business owner makes money as well. And it's about being able to sell the return on investment that it would take to go into that in depth, even with the stuff that you do, Phil. You know, you and I have spoken in the past, and it's financial well-being is about understanding personal individual drivers. You can't do that in a lunchtime session. But yeah. How responsible is the employer for providing that service?
It's a really good question, Sarah, because we're talking about like individual responsibility and group responsibility, aren't we? And I'm seeing this idea that like the stories that we tell ourselves about well-being are quite global across our society, and therefore they're now becoming global within organisations, within families, within individuals. And I would argue that perhaps what we all have a responsibility to do is make well-being part of our culture, which doesn't necessarily require financial investment.
No. Sorry,
Kate, go on.
I was just going to say, I think there is always going to be a cost to putting well-being into your business. But if it's a culture where, I don't even know if it needs to be well-being, it's about having engaged employees. So if you have engaged employees, they feel that they are appreciated and they feel they have purpose. And this is two of the main things that would help you to feel you have well-being. So of course, then individuals are going to have other things going on in their life that may need extra, more specific support. There is always going to be a line where, well, I can help you to this point, and then it does go beyond the responsibility of the employer. But actually, a lot of the stuff with good leadership and with understanding of people, motivation and behavior change within your business, you could do an awful lot just through good conversations, through the culture that you promote through your staff, and small things that make a difference. Like recently, I just heard someone saying that their business is giving you your birthday off, but it's not a holiday day, it's just an extra day. The difference that thing made, which yes, it costs money to give people a day off, but it made a huge difference for probably quite small investment, depending on the size of the business. So I don't know, I think it comes back to us being sold that wellness is something we have to buy. And that, in, you know, that is a big problem in the wellness industry. That, I mean, in my world, it's supplements, cleanses, detoxes, magic quick fixes, all this stuff you have to buy in order to be well. But what you're actually aiming for is something that's not really relevant or realistic to you. It's, we don't all need to be Gwyneth Paltrow or whatever. So wellness becomes extrapolated into something beyond what it really is. And then we end up with that kind of worried well thing of people feeling it's never enough or I always need more. So yeah, I guess I'm now waffling, but I think, you know, it is getting back to what actually makes people feel good at work. And that is probably the appreciation and having purpose. And you can do a lot of that through good conversations and leadership.
It absolutely is, and that's the only way you create that culture is by having quality conversations and quality discussions, and actually giving a damn about the people that you work with.
Yeah,
and I'm going to come back to the idea that actually, if we have that in our culture, that we have a culture, organizational culture, a family culture. A culture within ourselves of we actually give a damn. We ask the questions, how are you sleeping? You know, do you need some opportunities to move? Shall we set up a lunchtime walking group? You know, encouraging employees to do those things for each other as well. Talking about nutrition, like making sure people actually get time at lunch to go and source a proper meal, rather than giving them half an hour in which they've got to respond to the emails that they haven't actually had a chance to respond to. They've got to call so-and-so, so-and-so. They've got to call school back because their child's having a crisis at lunchtime. And then they don't get time to eat and they start, you know, snacking or relying on junk food, you know? If we've got a culture in ourselves where we prioritise ourselves, we look after ourselves well, and we give a damn about us and the others around us, then surely something's going to change in terms of well-being.
I do think that from regarding an employer perspective, and this is a valid point that Sarah makes about going back to that term, do I give a damn? You're caring for the most important asset in your business, which is the people. It's the people that make the business. So if we really want the business to succeed, then we need to do something to make sure that we're supporting and caring for the people that work for us as an employer. And the other thing as well is, if we don't do these things, the cost implications are enormous. People don't feel cared for, so they leave. So the cost of replacing them is phenomenal.
I think you're absolutely right. The one thing that I would say is, you know, the employer, that's a legal entity. That's not a being. So actually, what any business owner needs to focus on is making sure that they've got the right leadership people in place, because it's the people that make the people feel wanted. There isn't some mythical entity called the employer that will make people feel appreciated or wanted. So that's about having the right people in people management roles, who understand what that people management role is, has the skills to deliver that people management role that creates the culture that's being talked about. And endemic in this country and many other countries, I'm sure, we promote people that are good at their job to be people managers without even checking whether they've got any skills, any desire, because that's the only promotion route. That's the only success route that you've got. If you are going up the ladder, you are going to have to manage people.
And beyond that as well, I'd add on to that, Sarah, that actually when people are promoted into those positions, they're not supported well to learn the skills they need to manage people as well. No.
We kind of set people up for failure, don't we, in a sense? So we put people in these positions. I've seen it myself in my own career, people being put in positions who just didn't have the people skills, yet they were good at what they did. And all of a sudden now, it's almost like it's a big failure. It's causing greater problems for the organisation.
It's more fundamental than that, Phil. We don't even tell people what we expect of them as a people manager.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, I completely understand that. And I'm just to say, I'm conscious of time. And I know it's one of these subjects where there's so much to it. There's so much meat to the whole thing. And you really want to help a lot of people, employers included. Because some employers are afraid to go down certain routes because they don't want to get it wrong. They don't want it to cost them so much and then it not amount to anything at the end of the day. But for an individual as well, we hear so many, you know, where we want to support you in this, we want to support you in that. And people are going, yeah, I've heard that before. And, you know, so you're tackling some of these you know, experiences in life and beliefs to actually want to do something that's good, both for the employee and but also at the same time for the business itself.
What I see when people don't make change with their nutrition because they feel they have to overhaul their whole diet tomorrow and it feels overwhelming, so they do nothing. And so we talk about, well, what would be the first step? Like if you put an apple in your bag tomorrow, first step towards your goal, great, you're on your way. And maybe businesses feel this is like this massive thing that they've got to do. And actually, if they just stop and think, I want an overarching goal of improving staff well-being, because that fits with our company values of this, right? These are all the actions we can take in order to do that. And I can just start with this one small step. But before even doing any of that, what is it my staff want? Ask them what they want and need before you start wasting money on things you think they need. And then, oh, well-being wasn't worth the money like I thought. I've given myself the evidence that I don't want to do this anymore. And you stop. So it's very similar to kind of what I talk to my clients about, of just taking it right back to basics, finding out so that it's, you know, they've got autonomy in their choices. It's not just the business telling them what to do. You're doing the right things that are going to move you forward. And you, even if you're taking just small steps, all those steps, but in a year's time, you're going to have moved your business forward quite significantly without feeling you've put massive investment or time into it. So that's probably something people can think about to make well-being in the workplace more accessible, which will then mean when we're talking about people getting well-being, you know, do you need to be wealthy? Well, a lot of people work, obviously not everyone. So that gives more opportunity for more people to access well-being on a wider scale. So worth considering.
I'm really aware that we've opened a bit of a Pandora's box today and time is running short. So I'm going to wrap us up for today.
Yep. But,
you know, yep. The discussion's been really rich. Thank you, guys. Usually what we do at the end of a podcast is we ask you just to give us a few details about where people can find you if they want to get in contact with you. So Sarah, if somebody wanted to work with you, if somebody was looking for somebody to provide HR services or mediation, where would people get in contact with you?
Really simple, Sarah with an H at the end at hr2020thenumbers.co.uk.
Fabulous, thank you. And Kate, how about you? If somebody were wanting to look at their nutrition.
So you can message me on my website, it's katewallnutrition.co.uk, and you can follow me at Kate Wall Nutrition on LinkedIn and Instagram and Facebook. So yeah, at Kate Wall Nutrition is my socials.
Fabulous, thank you ever so much. Thank you so much for being here with us today, guys. Like I said, the discussion's been really rich and I feel like we could talk about this stuff all day long and still barely scratch the surface. So really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you from me as well. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you.
And as always, Phil, thank you for being a fabulous host.
And likewise yourself, Rachel. And on that note, I'd say goodbye to everyone.
Thanks, bye.